There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back, listeners of the 45th podcast. Rabia here, and I'm here this week with Susan. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia.
Today's Monday, the November the 5th, and we are still reeling from a terrible attack that took place yesterday, another mass shooting, and we're going to talk about that. We were all prepared to spend the bulk of this episode to talk about last week's attack. All this happening within 1 month of, you know, the terrible Vegas attack. It's hard to catch your breath.
It is. But we did have an excellent interview, which we prepared before recent events, in which we discussed the New York a terror attack.
Yeah, we had an interview with an expert on these issues, on terrorism, on these kinds of charges, and we're going to run that interview. But I want to first play the response. You know, as everybody knows, last week, an Uzbek national with a green card, which is permanent residency in the United States, rented a truck from Home Depot and ran into a bunch of people in New York City, then got out and had like a fake gun and was running around, and he was basically shot in the rear and survived and taken to a hospital. Killed 8 people, injured 11. This was Trump's response. Now, we're playing a clip, but this is literally 30 seconds into his response is where the clip picks up. So let's listen to this first.
My administration is coordinating closely between federal and local officials to investigate the attack and to further investigate this animal who did the attacking. And updates will be provided as available. I am today starting the process of terminating the diversity lottery program. I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program, diversity and diversity lottery. Diversity lottery sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good. It's not good. It hasn't been good. We've been against it. So we want to immediately work with Congress on the diversity lottery program, on terminating it, getting rid of it. We want a merit-based program where people come into our country based on merit. And we want to get rid of chain migration. This man that came in, or whatever you want to call him, brought in with him other people. And he was the point of contact, the primary point of contact for, and this is preliminarily, 23 people that came in or potentially came in with him.
All right. It's not uncommon or unusual when you have kind of a foreign suspect or somebody they think of as like a terrorist, like a Muslim in this case, to immediately go to policy issues around immigration. I mean, this happens every single time. There's two things that he mentioned in this clip. Number one, Trump said he wants to end the diversity lottery, but it's diversity lottery. And then he talked about chain migration. So I wanted to quickly just give a little bit of information to our listeners about these two issues before we get into the interview with Professor Steve Vladeck. The first is diversity lottery. Okay, so just so people understand, Ann Coulter gave an interview last week where she said, or over the weekend, I can't remember, where she said something like, we don't need diversity, we have a lot of diversity, get rid of this diversity. Okay, first of all of immigration contributes to diversity, not just this lottery. This visa category accounts for only 4% of all people who enter the United States on a visa, okay? And the way it works is this. The reason it was established 27 years ago, it sets aside 50,000 visas for people around the world who come from countries where much lower numbers of visas are being issued. And every year they'll come out with, it'll be a new list. Like, these are the countries that are not eligible this year. But if you're a national from any other country, you can enter the lottery. And Trump said something like, you know, these countries are sending their worst in the lottery. That's not how it works. Countries do not send the people in the diversity lottery. People themselves individually apply. They have to be vetted. They have to have at least a high school diploma or, you know, a certain standard of education. They go through an entire process. It's an individual application. Countries have nothing to do with it.
And Trump really seems to believe that it's actually the countries where they come from that do this. Like, they're the ones who choose and vet.
He is an idiot. He clearly knows nothing about it. This is so ideological. And I mean, even the Coulter thing. I mean, well, we don't want diversity. That's not what this is about. I mean, all of immigration contributes to diversity. So it's not that the diversity lottery is not to increase diversity here. That's not why it's called the diversity lottery. It's to diversify the package of visas we give out every year so that, like, China doesn't get, like, the bulk or India doesn't get the bulk, you know, so that we have – so we're kind of equitable in our distribution of visas. It's a very small – over, I think, like, 11 million people apply a year, a very small percentage. 50,000 get it. It's a drop in the bucket. So in 27 years now –
I mean, I had a friend growing up from England, and her family came over.
On diversity lottery?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, probably because a lot of Western countries don't have really high levels of immigration to the United States in terms of wanting to come and settle here. So that makes sense to me. And the other thing he said was about chain migration, and that is complete utter bullshit. What chain migration is this? It's like, I came here, now I'm going to sponsor my brothers and sisters, like, after I become a citizen. Number one, he's a green card holder. When you have a green card, you have very limited categories of people you can sponsor, like literally like a spouse and maybe minor children. You can't even sponsor like parents. You certainly can't sponsor siblings. There's no way this guy brought in 23 people on a green card. Like, he would have to have become a citizen, which takes like years, and then sponsor 23 siblings maybe, which takes 10 years to 15 years to get their visas. I don't even know. Like, he's just making shit up. So it doesn't work like that. But, you know, he has him and his dead-eye Stephen Miller advisor have been on diversity and chain migration for a long time. They really want to end the ability of people to bring in, like, siblings. And siblings is it, by the way. You cannot sponsor grandparents. You cannot sponsor aunts and uncles. You can't sponsor cousins. I mean, like, at least base your policy positions on real stuff. So that's all I wanted to say about the immigration stuff. Everything they're saying is bullshit. Anything you want to add before we go right into the interview?
I think the end of that covered it.
All right, sounds good. All right, let's listen. I'm really happy to welcome Professor Steve Vladeck this week on our show. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a professor at the University of Texas School of Law. He's a co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog, and also blogs at a number of other blogs, including Lawfare blog, and he's a co-host of his own podcast called the National Security Law Podcast. Hi, and welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So you caught my eye the other day when I saw a fantastic Twitter thread you did, a tweet storm you did about the response to President Trump and his response to the attack this week and did suggestion about what to do with the suspect. And so I just want to set up a little bit before we get into that. As our listeners know, this past Tuesday, an Uzbek national with a green card in the United States named Saifullah Saipov drove a truck into cyclists and pedestrians in New York City. He killed 8 people, injured nearly a dozen. And the president reacted in a few different ways. He did respond almost immediately on immigration policy, and we're going to discuss that separately. But what I want to talk to you is what you have, in fact, today written about in the Washington Post and also been talking about online. And that is the suggestion by not just the president, but also Senator Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and others saying that this suspect should be handed over to the military to be tried in military courts. So I want to unpack a lot of different issues related to this, but I first want to take a step back from this specific suspect and talk about, like, just how does somebody get charged with terrorism versus not being charged with terrorism? Like, really, almost immediately in the aftermath, like, within, like, a couple of hours, we were told that this is an act of terror, or most likely an act of terror. How does that determination made, and who decides?
Well, I mean, I think we have to be careful about the terminology here. You know, on the one hand, so I think it's it's obviously understandable that in the aftermath of any kind of, you know, mass casualty incident, we're going to have a colloquial response, and folks are going to be inclined to, you know, throw terms around like terrorism, act of terror, et cetera. I think we have to be careful to distinguish between, you know, what we all might think of and react to as acts of terrorism and what federal law treats as acts of terrorism. You know, for better or for worse, the federal definition really doesn't depend upon the body count on morbid sort of determinations of just how serious an event is. It's much more about why, you know, the perpetrator did what he did. And so I think, you know, the formal legal determination of whether a particular episode is an act of terrorism is one that I think is always going to be left to the federal law enforcement officials on the ground, even if we as a popular culture might react differently and might use different labels to describe, you know, the same horrific violent acts and incidents.
So you're talking specifically about kind of like, you know, what is the motive behind the attack? And as far as I know, an act of terrorism requires that the motive be related to either like a political, ideological, religious, you know, these kinds of motives. Is that correct?
So, I mean, I don't know about religion. The federal law really is focused on the political side of it, right? Is the purpose of the violence to instill fear in the population, to achieve some kind of political, you know, sort of motivation? There are actually about 23 different definitions in federal law, right? I think the more important point here is just that the sort of the immediate aftermath of a tragic and horrible incident like what happened on Tuesday, you know, the first priority, I think, is making sure, obviously, that you're taking care of the victims. The second priority is making sure that this is a one-off thing, right, and that this is not part of some broader coordinated series of attacks. And I think, you know, the government has a tendency, guys, for better or for worse, right, to make some pretty quick generalizations that may or may not hold up under scrutiny as time goes on. But, you know, contrast the immediate aftermath of Tuesday's attack, for example, to the Las Vegas shooting and, you know, how folks reacted to them, how they labeled them. At the end of the day, I mean, I think we might get lost in the sort of moral and philosophical debate about labeling here. I think the more important point is, you know, no one disputes that what happened on Tuesday was a federal crime. And whatever you want to call it was something that's within the purview of federal authorities to investigate and to prosecute.
Yeah, I think the real, I don't think there's any debate there. I think the real debate is for folks who question, like, well, how come Dylann Roof wasn't a federal crime, or how come the Las Vegas, and
no, God, yeah, I mean, Robin, I completely agree. Right. I think what one of the things that we're learning is that, you know, federal criminal law is a very odd patchwork of specific offenses that, you know, frankly, sometimes cover things we don't understand why they cover, and then other times don't cover things that we think they should. And so, you know, I realize that oftentimes the appearance is actually pretty ugly about which cases get treated which way. That's certainly not helped in this case by the rhetoric coming out of the president and others within his administration. I just think we shouldn't overlook that some of the problem here lies in how federal criminal law just has been drafted and what kind of incidents it prioritizes over others.
But practically speaking, what would the advantages be, or the perceived advantages anyway, of treating this as a not a regular criminal case, but treating it as an act of war and going the military tribunal route?
Well, I mean, I think that there are sort of a series of different interlocking advantages. I mean, if we put aside the sort of the politics and the messaging for a second and just focus on the law, I mean, if you have an individual of whatever nationality, of whatever religious orientation, who is fighting on behalf of Al-Qaeda or one of its affiliates, that is to say, groups we have authorized the use of military force against, then that gives the government leverage and flexibility when it comes to what to do with this individual once we've taken them into custody. So if you or I or any of your listeners goes out on the street and commits a crime, you know, the government doesn't have choices. The choice is prosecute or not prosecute. But if you get someone who actually is part of Al-Qaeda and has committed some kind of criminal act against the United States, you know, the government will sit back and say, well, wait a second, we can try them in civilian court, and in almost every case today, that's what we do. But we also have these other options. We have the prospect of long-term military detention in sort of a quasi-prisoner of war status, which is, you know, the 41 detainees who are still at Guantanamo today, or at least 31 of those 41. And then we have the military commission option, which is, if we think the criminal act was actually a violation of the laws of war, maybe we can try them in a Guantanamo military commission. That's 10 of the 41 guys who are still at Guantanamo. So I think the practical implications are just with respect to what kind of flexibility the government has, what kind of leverage it has. And guys, just to be clear, I mean, that's a much more important question when we're talking about someone who is captured overseas.
In an actual wartime scenario.
In an actual, right, on a battlefield, in a combat theater, et cetera. You know, the government's modus operandi down through the Bush administration and the Obama administration has been that folks who are arrested here, with exactly two exceptions to date, if you're arrested here, you get put into criminal custody, you get charged, you get tried, you get prosecuted, you get sent to jail.
Yeah. I will say from the, and this is going by tweets, God help us all, but from Lindsey Graham's and McCain's tweets and some of the other Republicans, it does seem like their interest here is focused really heavily on the interrogation aspect, which raises a lot of alarm bells for me. They're like, they don't want Miranda. Okay, so no Miranda reading, but also no right to counsel, period.
Just to explain to listeners, like, why this difference makes a difference. So the question is that if he was handed over to the military, would he have the same rights to counsel? Whereas here, he is Mirandized. But the thing is, he has waived his right to counsel, so there's that. But what they're raising, one of the issues they're raising is that, well, he'd get all these rights in this kind of proceeding versus being handed over to the military, and the interrogation, I guess, tactics that can be used can give us much more valuable intelligence versus him saying, clamming up and saying, give me a lawyer, I'm not going to talk. And so he has a different set of rights, right?
Robbie, that's exactly right. But I think, I mean, the point I would make is, as what you guys just said is points out, I mean, this is not a case where that's the problem, right? So the, you know, Lindsey Graham and John McCain have this habit of trotting out this false dichotomy that basically the choice is put the guy in the criminal justice system, at which point he will clam up and provide no actionable intelligence, or hold him in military detention so we can interrogate him, you know, and get all of the crown jewels. And it's just never that stark a proposition. For the most part, folks who end up in the criminal justice system do end up talking, right? Even if they have to be interrogated outside of Miranda. I mean, Miranda is an exclusionary rule. It doesn't actually stop the government from interrogating suspects. It just limits what you can use against them at trial if it was obtained without the Miranda warning. And even there, there's an exception for questions that were asked basically in the interest of protecting public safety, where the answers can still come in even if the defendant hadn't been Mirandized. So right there, you know, that's the government has the ability to interrogate and prosecute. And I think what Lindsey Graham and John McCain are holding out is this, you know, sort of straw man that just doesn't happen. The terrorist suspect who has all of this good stuff and who will only tell us if we send him to Guantanamo.
So we are just a couple weeks away from the holiday season beginning. And Susan, I'd love to hear your family's holiday traditions. How do you guys celebrate the season?
We go to Waffle House in the morning on Christmas.
On Christmas morning, really?
Yeah. That's like the one Simpson family Christmas tradition.
I think that's awesome. Mom gets a break.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
That's good. Well, I'm Muslim, but I will tell you this. I am that Muslim who celebrates Christmas in any way, shape, and possible that she can without quite excommunicating myself. But we do Thanksgiving, and we always have a Thanksgiving turkey. The last 3-4 years, it's been a deep-fried turkey, which is so exciting. We're already...
That's what we've done, too. It's so much... Well, not easier, because you might burn yourself, but better.
You might kill yourself, but it is a delicious bird.
We've done great so far, so here's hoping for like a third straight Thanksgiving of no oil disasters.
How do you guys exchange gifts? You do Secret Santa, or you just like everybody gets a gift, or how does it work in your family? I just longingly watch people exchange Christmas gifts.
Typically, my sister and I get each other gifts, and my parents get us things that we should definitely have more of, like socks.
Well, this year, Bombas socks are probably the socks that you and your sister are both going to want, because you and I know we've both been wearing Bombas socks for at least the last year, and they are some of the most comfortable socks I have owned.
They are super high quality. For me, I mean, I think they're great running socks. That's why I like them so much.
You said you just ordered some, right, yesterday too?
Yeah.
Yep.
I got the leopard print, because... Why not?
Why not? Why not feel hot inside those running shoes? I finally put on my first pair of long boots because the season's gotten cold enough, and I pulled out some long Bombas socks this weekend, and they felt great. So, you know, when it comes to fighting freezing winter, and actually even in the summer, you know, their socks in the summer keep you very cool. They're not like other socks. They don't make your feet sweaty. They wick the sweat up. But right now, as it's getting colder, well, Bombas socks are like sweaters for your feet. And every single pair that you buy, they donate a pair to someone in need, which I think is just lovely.
This holiday season, Bombas is bringing everyone together and giving you and your loved ones and those in need the gift of quality and comfort. So buy your pair at bombas.com/45th today and get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/45th for 20% off of your first Bombas order. Remember, that's bombas.com/45th.
You you said earlier that, you know, in situations like this, the government or authorities have, they have options here, right? I mean, so they can go the military route because of the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force. But doesn't that specify, like, there's certain act, like you said Al-Qaeda, but ISIS is not included in that group of people that, you know, like, would allow that option, it seems to me. But what is the legal kind of analysis on that?
So that's right. I mean, so in general, I mean, right, the what I was saying a couple minutes ago sort of assumes that you have someone who's clearly part of Al-Qaeda, right? One of the real issues that's raised by Saipov's case and also by the John Doe U.S. citizen who are currently holding in military detention in Iraq is that it's not actually settled that the 2001 authorization for the use of military force indeed applies to ISIS. There are arguments both ways. The government's theory is that ISIS is basically a derivative of Al-Qaeda, that it's a splinter group. And so just like if during World War II some sort of splinter group had hived off of Nazi Germany, we wouldn't have needed a separate declaration of war to go after them. Mm. You know, it's not a preposterous theory, but it's also not one that's ever been tested in the courts. And so, you know, I think one of the sort of real reasons why it makes no sense, even if you are less concerned than I am about some of the sort of problems with Guantanamo, even from the government's perspective, it makes no sense to use this as a test case because, you know, you don't want to risk losing that fight. And if you ever have to go to court and litigate the question of whether ISIS is covered by the AUMF, the last case you want to do it in is where the person whose liberty is literally hanging in the balance has constitutional rights like a green card holder like Saipov.
That's what I'm stuck on here. I'm having a hard time pinning down what exactly they're hoping to get by these claims that they should be doing it as a prisoner of war, essentially, or as an enemy combatant. Because I don't see what they gain in terms of like speed, in terms of security of conviction, in terms of ease, in terms of intelligence.
Susan, I think there's a perception, and I don't know. I don't know that we have any evidence to support it. I think there's a perception that the gain is all on the intelligence side, right? That you're not actually going to accomplish anything. And I mean, I think, right, Lindsey Graham and John McCain aren't dumb, right? Like, they understand that Guantanamo has been a nightmare. They understand that the military commission system has been completely inefficient and a terrible way to actually obtain justice. I think this is all about the interrogation intelligence gathering piece for them. And I think that's why it's so important to stress, you know, that it's just not true that the government has been unable to obtain intelligence from folks who have been prosecuted in the civilian courts. I mean, you know, maybe if that were true, maybe if there were clear evidence to support their view, we'd have to have a harder, longer fight about this. But it's just, it assumes facts, not in evidence. I think that's why it's so frustrating.
And the facts in this case also seem like they wouldn't really support this argument because this guy sounds like, you know, he's been charged with in federal court with terrorism, material support of ISIS, which I'd love to talk to you about a little bit about what that means. But it doesn't sound like he had a real connection or he was being directed by the group, but that he was just kind of this lone wolf who was looking at stuff online. He like had, you know, videos on his phone and he was kind of a
self-radicalized, that term?
A self-radicalized, self-made terrorist. And so what kind of intelligence could he even possibly have other than I Googled this stuff or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. And frankly, I'm sure the answer is not much. But, you know, I think the Graham McCain worldview is we don't know until we have that conversation with them. And we can't have that conversation with them if you are giving them, you know, if you're giving these suspects Miranda rights and full access to the courts.
Or you can have it and then just trust that you have enough evidence. Otherwise, you get the conviction anyway. It's not like you can't proceed.
No, I mean, this is why I think Graham and McCain are capitalizing on public misconceptions of Miranda, right? So I think there's this view out there that, you know, oh, the Miranda rule, that means that you can never interrogate someone unless they agree, right? And, you know, the lawyer is going to protect them. That's just, you know, any criminal defense lawyer will tell you that's not how Miranda works. Right. Even assuming a non-cooperating suspect, and here we have a cooperating suspect, the government has lots of ways to still interrogate the individual to try to obtain, you know, useful information without advising them of their Miranda rights, without, you know, having the presence of counsel there. It just limits the government's ability to use that evidence against them. And guys, when you have someone like Saipov, who's literally caught red-handed, it's not going to matter what he says in his interrogation. The government doesn't need any of that for their criminal case against him. So, you know, that's why I just think this is such a frustrating public debate because, you know, folks like McCain and Graham are seizing on, I think, a lack of sophisticated understanding of just how much flexibility the government has, even in an ordinary civilian criminal prosecution.
We talked about that he's a green card holder. And constitutionally, you don't have to be a green card holder to have constitutional protections, right? You have to be a person who's present on U.S. soil, basically, is my understanding.
Well, it's a complicated area in terms of what rights we're talking about and what the constitutional issues are at play. But as a green card holder on American soil, yes, he has basic constitutional rights consistent with what any American would get in the criminal justice system. The question is whether or not he's going through that route or through the Guantanamo way.
That decision, I guess my question is that this. I mean, like, Trump and others have said that, well, he should be turned over to the military, and then he kind of hedged a bit. But the question is, who can ultimately make that decision? Can the commander-in-chief say, nope, turn him over to the military? I mean, can he just order that to happen?
I mean, he can. You know, this is sort of a classic interagency kind of process from the sort of bureaucratic standpoint, where it's not really up to any one, you know, cabinet official. I mean, obviously, the Justice Department has a lot to say about this. The Defense Department has a lot to say about this. So does the State Department. And so these are decisions that really are up to the president. You know, we know, for example, that it was President Bush himself who signed off on transferring Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen arrested on U.S. soil, to military detention. We know that President Bush signed off on doing it for Ali Al-Mari, the one non-citizen, you know, arrested in the U.S. who was sent to military detention. So, you know, it is the president's decision. I just think that in this case, and maybe this is not unique to this case, the president is more than a little misinformed about what the relevant considerations are. And I think is, you know, his instinct is to say things that he think will excite and rally his base as opposed to what's actually a good idea.
But let's talk about what the problems are with Guantanamo for a second. Aside from the recent terror attack in New York, this is a very timely issue because of a recent, I guess, conviction in Guantanamo involving General John Baker.
Yeah, I mean, a conviction might be strong, but there's this amazingly bizarre episode playing out, I mean, literally as we're speaking, in one of the three pending military commission cases. So, you know, the military commissions, which, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, are set up to try, you know, violations of the laws of war by enemy combatants, including, you know, terrorism suspects fighting for al-Qaeda and their affiliates, they've been charging ahead. I mean, right, they've been going on for 15 years. They've only gotten 8 convictions so far, but there are 3 ongoing trials, including the trial of the 9-11 masterminds, at least the alleged 9-11 masterminds. Anyway, these cases are all in pretrial proceedings, and there's this huge ethical issue that's arisen where the lawyers for one of the defendants have basically withdrawn because they claim right. that they are worried that the government is basically interfering with their ability to communicate with their client, although a lot of the details are classified, so we don't know much more than that.
What do we know factually about that, other than that it seems to be a situation where communications between the attorneys and their client are being intercepted?
Yeah, I mean, that's about all we know from the record. We don't, you know, so I should just say, I mean, apparently there's a lot more than just that that's been sort of filed under seal in the military commissions and in the D.C. federal court, right, that this is not just speculation, that they actually have some physical evidence that this has happened, and that as a result, they're not able to actually represent their clients in a manner that comports with their ethical obligations. So this led 3 of the lawyers on the Nashiri team, the defendant's team, to ask General John Baker, who is the chief defense counsel for the whole military commission system, to be released, to be allowed to sort of step off the case because they couldn't continue to participate without violating their ethical obligations. Baker said yes, and the military commission judge turned around and said Baker didn't have the authority to do it without the judge's approval. When Baker said, I disagree, he was thrown in jail for contempt. And so, you know, we actually have the first new Guantanamo detainee since 2008, and it's a 1-star Marine Corps general, you know, who's been sent to not the brig, I mean, he's been confined to quarters for nothing other than, you know, raising a serious ethical issue in the commissions.
From what we know, it sounds as if these attorneys reached a point where they decided the only move they could make was not to play. And the military is saying, actually, you can't make that move either.
And I should say, I mean, so there was a hearing this morning in the D.C. Federal District Court, you know, Thursday morning in the D.C. District Court, where the federal judge at the hearing, Judge Royce Lamberth, basically said that the ethical problem underlining this whole dispute, Judge Lamberth said, was, quote, shocking, unquote. So this is not just, you know, a frolic and a lark by defense lawyers trying to cause trouble. This is a real issue.
There's something horrific going on down there. It seems like something is very, very far from protecting his rights. I don't know if it's I've heard it's so hard to piece together what's going on, but a lot of the talk does seem to focus on possible even torture and resulting brain damage of the defendant.
I mean, certainly, right, so in Nasri's case, I mean, Nasri is, we know from the Senate torture report, one of the high-level detainees who was subjected to some of the worst abuses of the CIA rendition detention interrogation program back in the early part of the last decade. We have no reason to think that that's still going on today, but it's just, you know, it is this baggage hanging over this case, and all the more reason why, you know, the relationship between him and his lawyers, the ability to sort of believe that the government's not interfering with that relationship, is really essential to him getting a fair trial. You know, the other piece of this is because this is a capital case, right, the government's seeking the death penalty against Nasri, he is entitled by statute and by the Constitution to have a not just a lawyer, but what's called a learned counsel, right, which is sort of someone with experience doing capital cases. Well, his learned counsel is one of the lawyers who resigned. And so the case literally can't go ahead without a learned counsel, or else it will be void the second it happens. We'll be spending years prosecuting a guy when everyone agrees that the government had no power to do it. So it's just sort of a day in the life of Guantanamo. And guys, just to sort of tie this full circle, exactly why it's so just dumb to have this knee-jerk reaction that, you know, when you have a terrorism suspect, Guantanamo is the right answer. It is not the right answer to just about any question.
And also, it seems like Trump's main concern here is fee, which is like the last thing you're going to get.
No, that's right. I mean, I think President Trump tweeted, you know, I think after his original tweet storm on Wednesday, you know, I think Thursday morning, he finally said, oh, well, statistically, Guantanamo takes a while.
Right.
That's putting it mildly. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the 9/11 case, I think, is a really good example, right? I mean, you have just about the worst criminal act, right, the worst act of international terrorism that the U.S. has ever experienced. You have Attorney General Holder, you know, pushing at least early in the Obama administration for the 9/11 defendants to be tried in federal court. The Obama administration walked away from that. And so that case is now, you know, we're 8 years past that decision, and we're still early in the pretrial proceedings in that case. If that case had gone ahead in federal court, you know, that trial would be over by now. And if the government made its case, those guys would be convicted and quite possibly not just sentenced to death, but executed by now. That's not something to celebrate. It's just an observation that, you know, the civilian criminal justice system doesn't get caught up in these kinds of roadblocks because it's not constantly surrounded by the kinds of legitimacy concerns that threaten to upend the Guantanamo commissions on, as we've seen lately, just about a daily basis.
That was also highly politicized. If I remember correctly, when that was raised, that wasn't there like a movement among all these conservative governors said, not in my state, you're not bringing them, like nobody was going to take these inmates, we're not going to like house them here, we're not going to house them there. I mean, that's what I kind of recall from that time. And then
there was definitely a NIMBY, you know, a NIMBY reaction to that. I guess, you know, I think it was a huge mistake on the part of the Obama administration to cave to that political pressure, because the second they did, I think it became clear to everybody in Congress and to all these local officials that if they just, you know, made enough noise, they'd be able to sort of, you know, kowtow the administration into submission. And that's part of why we are still where we are today, back at Guantanamo, with, you know, this week's just completely Kafkaesque developments.
Well, you know, one thing, Trump doesn't just want swift justice. He also wants strong justice. And so he tweeted that he hopes this guy gets the death penalty. And can you talk about the repercussions of that kind of pronouncement?
Well, I mean, so it's one, you know, obviously, I think a lot of folks would say, well, you know, we think the same thing. I mean, folks who aren't categorically opposed to the death penalty might look at an incident like Tuesday and say that's what it was made for. But there's just a difference between saying, you know, we ought to pursue the death penalty, which is what you'll often hear prosecutors say, and saying this guy, right, this specific person, Saipov, should be given the death penalty, right? It is the president of the United States basically not just convicting the guy in the court of public opinion, but sentencing him as well. And there's a real concern that I'm sure Saipov's lawyers will eventually raise, that those comments could, you know, taint and otherwise prejudice the jury. And could somehow, you know, create a serious due process concern that even if the jury returns a death sentence, it won't be necessarily clear that was for the right reasons as opposed to political pressure. So, you know, it's just not wise on the president's part. I mean, he's, as I think we've seen a number of times, guys, his tweeting may be his own worst enemy in achieving the policy outcomes he wants.
If one thing happens from the Trump administration, it's that lawyers will now know the blue book rules for setting tweets.
Well, we've come a long way. But I mean, you know, the Bo Bergdahl case is another example of this, where, you know, the president's public comments and his tweets are probably going to make it that much harder for the military judge to impose a relatively harsher as opposed to relatively more lenient sentence, you know, which, frankly, many of President Trump's critics might be totally fine with. But it's just, it's not appropriate behavior for anyone holding that office.
Having the president call for someone's death is horrific in any circumstance. And I think that it'd be more than ever, especially for this defendant now, I hope the death penalty doesn't happen because it causes so many problems and so many concerns.
And it may not. I mean, listen, ultimately the charging decision, at least initially, is made by the line prosecutors. You know, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan for the Southern District of New York, you know, they're incredibly smart, sophisticated, really experienced lawyers. They could very well not even pursue a death sentence just to avoid this whole mess. But, you know, if that's true, I mean, and they may not have anyway, even if President Trump hadn't opened his mouth or, you know, at least his Twitter account.
But we'll never know now.
We'll never know. And it's just yet further proof that, you know, the president just, when you have the president with the mentality of a narcissistic 5-year-old, it creates lots of legal problems.
Well, if they don't pursue it at this point, I'm sure they'll be hearing from the president again on Twitter.
Which is, and it is, you know, related, but also unrelated. The degradation of the separation between the DOJ and the president is probably going to come in play here, too.
I mean, guys, in the president's comments that, you know, the justice system is weak and a laughing stock.
I'd almost forgotten about that. And that was only like 24 hours ago.
Who is laughing at the American criminal justice system other than the president, who seems completely incapable of understanding it? Mm.
That's a excellent place to end, I think, wrap up here. Unless, Susan, you have anything else to add?
No, but thank you. It's very helpful. A lot of the listeners I know want to hear more about what exactly is going on with all these calls for Guantanamo. And hopefully I'll give them an explainer for where we're headed next.
I'd love to help. And of course, you know, happy to have you guys send folks to our podcast, too.
And by the way, can you please tell our listeners how they can find you online and where they can find your writings and your podcasting and all that? Tell us how to find you online.
Yeah, sure. So on Twitter, I'm @Steve_Vladek. That's Vladeck. I write for Just Security, which is www.justsecurity.org, or on Twitter @just_security. And my colleague Bobby Chesney and I find lots of things to fight about on the National Security Law Podcast, which is www.nationalsecuritylawpodcast.com or @NSLPodcast. Where if you really want to hear much nerdier and far less, I think, interesting discussions of these topics, we try to provide at least one episode a week to do just that.
I'm going to listen. I can't wait. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
No, thank you, guys. And thanks for having me on.
Have you gotten some of the wines, by the way?
Yeah.
All right. Tell me all about these wines.
Yeah. So if you're the kind of person who likes drinking wine, but is not the kind of person who's like a wine person like me, there is a great product you should try, which is First Leaf. First Leaf is a wine club that doesn't need you to know the difference between wines beyond red and white, which I've got that one down, but they help you figure out what kind of wines you really like. And I got my first First Leaf order a few weeks ago, and I'm waiting for my second one. And these are some damn good wines. Here's how it works. You first customize your First Leaf order by selecting the color, wine regions, and frequency of wine shipments. And then First Leaf creates an introductory 3-pack of wine to get you started. With First Leaf's intro pack, you'll get all three wines for just $5 each. Normally, these bottles of wine go for $20 each, if not more. And then, when your order arrives, you drink the wine, and then you rate it to get personalized recommendations of what wine to get in the future. The more wines you rate, the better your recommendations will be. And First Leaf also eliminates the middleman and works directly with the world's foremost wineries in France, Italy, and Napa Valley. First Leaf is for sure my new favorite way of rating and buying quality wine.
So to order your 3-pack of introductory wine for $15, go to tryfirstleaf.com/45th. That's 3 bottles of wine for only $15, which seems ridiculously cheap to me. But anyway, at tryfirstleaf.com/45th. And like Susan, experience First Leaf today for yourself at tryfirstleaf.com/45th.
Or use it as Christmas gifts and just pretend you have good taste in wine.
That's a great idea. Okay, so that was a great discussion, and I really hope Stephen comes back. All right, so fast forward a week, and now we are facing what is Texas's worst mass shooting. Yesterday on Sunday, a gunman went to a Baptist church in Sutherland, Texas, tiny little town, around 600 people who live in that town, and killed nearly 4% of the population there. He ended up killing, well, some reports are saying 26 people, some reports are saying 27 people. Nearly half of them are children. The youngest is 18 months old. It's awful. It's so awful. Another couple dozen have been badly injured and are in the hospital. One five-year-old boy actually was shot 5 times, but is in recovery, thank God. One family had 4 of their kids shot. So let's talk a little bit about this guy, what we know about him, the perp here, Devin.
I'll just say I'm going to object to that, saying his name. I think we should not say it.
All right.
I mean, okay. It doesn't matter who he is. It's a controversial issue. A lot of news organizations do it differently. But who he is doesn't really matter, other than the fact it's the typical thing you'd expect. He has a history of child abuse, spouse battery, apparently beating his dog.
He was court-martialed. He's ex-military, ex-U.S. Air Force. So there's that, too. And he was actually sentenced to military prison, apparently.
Yeah, and it seems like, again, it's domestic violence-oriented. It sounds like his mother-in-law was sort of the target. It's not really clear yet. But, again, he had a assault rifle. Yeah, that's something just happens in America. Apparently, we don't care.
Yeah, it keeps happening. So, I mean, kind of the overview of what happened is I think he showed up at the church around 11 a.m., dressed in tactical gear, and came up in an SUV, got out, took out this automatic rifle, I think a Ruger automatic rifle, which was never meant for civilian use, by the way, by the person who created it or developed it, but started shooting up the church from the outside, then went inside, shot it up. And I'm not sure exactly what happened there. There was somebody in the church or somebody next door.
A neighbor.
It was a neighbor, right? Who heard it and came out and started exchanging fire with him. Before he gets in his car, somebody who's driving past all this happening sees these exchange of gunfire, sees the guy peel away. That neighbor comes up to this other guy in the car and's like, we got to get him. And so he hops into the truck and they take off on a high-speed chase after this guy. And he ends up crashing his car somewhere and they pull up at a distance behind him and keep, the guy gets out, the neighbor with the rifle, he has a rifle, keeps it trained on it. And I guess until the cops come and the perp is dead inside. And I don't actually know if it's because he killed himself.
I don't think we know yet, or at least not last I saw.
We don't know yet. Okay. If it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound or if it was the car accident that killed him.
I mean, part of me is is this even newsworthy now? Because this happens all the time. And, you know, it's body count gets the national news, but this does go on a smaller scale without any sort of coverage whatsoever all over the U.S. I mean, it's a daily occurrence. This is a higher body count, but that's really the only substantive difference between this and every single day ending in a Y.
Yeah, I mean, 11,000 people this year have died in the United States from gunshot wounds. I mean, that's incredible. 11,000.
We just don't care. We've decided as a nation that we actually value we put a higher value on the right of someone to own an assault rifle than we do on not having children slaughtered. I mean, what do you do at that point? That's who we are as a nation. That's who this country is. And you know what? If you subjectively value holding a gun that much, and you have the voting power and the constitutional backing, what are you going to do about it?
Well, let's listen to what the president, who's on his first leg of his Asia tour, so he's in Japan when he gave these remarks, actually said about in response to the attack.
I think that mental health is your problem here. This was a very, based on preliminary reports, very deranged individual, a lot of problems over a long period of time. We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries. But this isn't a guns situation. I mean, we could go into it, but it's a little bit soon to go into it. But fortunately, somebody else had a gun that was shooting in the opposite direction. Otherwise, it would have been as bad as it was. It would have been much worse. But this is a mental health problem at the highest level. It's a very, very sad event. These are great people and a very, very sad event. But that's the way I view it.
Yeah, so just for the record, this is not a thing that can happen anywhere. For instance, it cannot happen in Japan.
Right. And here's the thing. The World Health Organization says that, according to their most latest report on this, nearly 1 in 4 people globally suffer some level of mental illness. It can be a whole range of things, from very severe psychiatric problems to depression and all the kinds. So to suggest that it's a global phenomenon. Mental health is, people everywhere suffer from it, but not everywhere in the world do people have access to guns like this. And that's what separates us from the rest of the world. That's why it can't happen everywhere.
And I think it was maybe not the first, but it was very close to one of the first bills that Trump signed as president, which was to increase access to firearms for the mentally ill.
Right. So, I mean, even if that's the argument he's making, and then he goes on to make the argument. And then we have also, I think, the Attorney General of Texas was like, well, that just means maybe parishioners should have guns.
Yes, we need more guns in the church. And then, of course, Trump's all, thank God there's a good guy with a gun to stop it after 26 people were murdered.
Right. I don't think that good guy showed up and stopped him when he was inside. He was already leaving the church, having killed a bunch of people and hurt a lot of people when that guy showed up. And I'm glad that he was, you know, run down and shot down or whatever, but it wouldn't have prevented.
The death toll was not lower because there was a good guy with a gun. It'd be
exactly.
lower if we had less access to firearms. Yeah. I mean, I feel really helpless on this issue. I don't know if we can change it. I'm glad people are trying, but I think I feel a sense of despair on this one. It's not even Trump related. It's just intrinsically our country is so fucked up in this issue, it may not be resolvable.
Yeah. And I really wonder, because this is like a God and guns country where this happened, right? I really do wonder what the response of locals will be to something like this. I mean, this is devastating for a town. This is a town, I mean, 600 people, I'm assuming everybody knows everybody, you know, there. And such a tremendous loss in a place. I mean, they're talking about thoughts and, you know, sending prayers. I mean, like they're in a church, they're already praying. So that certainly didn't prevent this from happening. And I don't know. So I would be very curious to hear the local response to this.
Well, the conservative media's response has been to, and like Donald Trump Jr. and all them, has been to attack all the liberals for criticizing the thoughts and prayers response. As if we're of course Democrats are going to lose forever. They're now attacking prayer in response to people saying, like, we need more than thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
But like the thing is, there's no other situation which the response is thoughts and prayers.
This is true. Well, and this happens literally every time one of these things happens. But, you know, these pieces keep getting re-upped. And a couple of the pieces I'm seeing circulated this morning are about the connection to like mass shootings and domestic violence. And there is a real statistically significant connection here. Apparently close to like 16-17% of men who, first of all, 98% of mass shootings are done by men. That's a statistic. I don't know how many of them are white, but I'm guessing it's a really high number. But beyond that, 16% of them have already had on their record some kind of DV, a domestic violence record. So they've been, you know, charged or convicted or whatever with assaulting a family member, usually a female. In about half of these situations, somebody from the family of that shooter is killed in the incident, or it begins with somebody in the family, then they go out on a rampage. And so, you know, I think this is kind of an interesting, because this is actually, there's evidence to show that, you know, in terms of like an indicator here, more so than mental illness, this is a phenomenon that needs to be, the one connection that can easily be made is if you have a DV record, you can't get a gun, period.
And we do have laws that are designed toward that end, but they also have massive loopholes and are inconsistently enforced.
Okay, so this is a situation that's still unfolding. If we have more information, of course, we'll talk about it next week. And honestly, I do send my thoughts and prayers, but it's not enough. I mean, it's simply not enough. It's not going to save anybody going forward. All right, so we're going to move on to a couple of other things coming out of this White House. So there's been some really interesting developments in Saudi Arabia. First of all, Jared Kushner has made 3 trips to Saudi Arabia in this year, which, you know, is pretty, I don't know, I think that's fairly frequent. He made one that was basically not even like on the, it was like kind of off the record trip just last week. And then right in the wake of it, and it's been clear that this administration is pretty close to both the Saudi royal family and also a lot of the Gulf states. And so right after he comes back from his trip, I think, and then right after that, something remarkable happens in Saudi Arabia, which is that there is this very young crown prince right now. The crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, he's like 32 years old. He is, I think, just came into power like in the last year. Very young guy, and he has promised all kinds of reforms, including, I think not very recently, said we're going to totally go back to an Islam that is not like the Islam that has been around, that we've been practicing, and basically has been a state religion for decades now, which is Wahhabism, which actually is a relief if they actually do that, but for most of the Muslim world that despises that really austere kind of puritanical form. And then he's been on an anti-corruption campaign. So apparently he announced the formation of an anti-corruption, I guess, department or something. And within hours of that announcement, made a series of arrests of very high level Saudi names, including other princes. There's 11 Saudi princes were arrested, including Al-Walid bin Talal. Al-Walid bin Talal is very well known in Western circles. He has endowed...
One of the richest people in the world.
He's one of the richest people in the world. He has endowed things everywhere. I mean, he has an endowment at Georgetown University. He has funded so much stuff inside the Beltway, I can't even tell you. He is a darling, really, of much of the Western intellectual establishment. And so he...
Trump hates him.
Trump probably does hate him. And you know
he
what?
He does. Actually, no, he's literally... He does tweet about it. He hates him.
Like well, you know
in
what?
2015.
I think during the election, this guy tweeted some insults at Trump, and maybe that's what it is. He called on him to drop out of the presidential election. So he actually said, "You're a disgrace, not only to the GOP." So yeah, this is I think very coordinated and with the blessings of the Trump administration, if not with
the
urging.
Well, that's the question. I mean, what was Kushner doing over there? Why was he staying up with the prince till 4 a.m. making plans? That's what one report said, anyway.
I don't know. I don't think it's a coincidence that this happened shortly thereafter. And I think, you know, what people are saying in terms of like what this is, and I don't know all the implications of what's happening in Saudi. In fact, it'd be great if we could have an expert on to tell us. But it's really about consolidating power. I mean, this guy has removed all these guy people. I mean, like they are being held like under house arrest in a very rich hotel. But the point is, their assets have been frozen.
Yeah, a lot of money.
That's billions of dollars, which I don't know where it's going to go, but I wonder about...
You don't just lock up someone with $27 billion without something... I mean, they have resources to fight back. That's something that's going to...
Fighting back in Saudi might look different than fighting back in the United States, though. And so that's... I do wonder, like, what the options here are. But, I mean, for those 27, I'm guessing, I mean, like, if things go the way... A lot of times they do in this part of the world is that they will come to some kind of agreement and be like, I'm giving up XYZ and I'm going to be exiled forever. And all the power is yours, Salman. Now, but here's the thing. The day after this happens, there's like this bizarre helicopter crash too. And a senior Saudi prince and like seven other officials, high level Saudi officials were all killed in this helicopter crash. And people also are pointing that this particular prince was also being implicated in some of the anti-corruption stuff. And this was just... That it's not a coincidence, and maybe this is also one more move towards consolidating his power.
We should also mention, too, there's amid all of this turmoil, there is a missile fired at Riyadh and intercepted. And now there's talk of like an act of war by Iran, is what some Saudi officials are claiming. They're the Houthis.
Yeah, this missile landed near Riyadh, major city in Saudi Arabia. And initially, the reports were like that the Houthis in Yemen, which are a Iran-backed faction that Saudi has been relentlessly attacking, like, you know, they've been like bombing Yemen for a while now with our help, that it was them. And now there is an official Saudi statement. This is like an act of war by Iran, which is a pretty dangerous situation. And there's also a lot of coordination between Israeli security and Israeli government and Saudi. And so, you know, and the Gulf states and all of them, their common enemy really isn't Iran. I think it's very likely we're going to see something happen, like an actual war between Iran and I don't know who, between all of these.
It's so Saudi alone, like civil war could happen here. It's very risky what they're doing. It's not clear they can actually pull off the consolidation of power the way they plan. I mean, there's so many unknowns now and so many horrific consequences of them that the possibility that the president and his son-in-law are involved and, you know, greenlighting this is pretty horrific.
His fat little fingers are in it, definitely. I mean
his little tweeting fingers, maybe. I mean, this is definitely on like the conspiracy level still. But I wonder a lot about the tweet sent out by Trump that morning when he asked for Saudi Arabia to put Aramco stock on the like New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
Random and so weird. And then suddenly, a few hours later, this coup takes off. Like,
it's not random.
I feel I'm going overboard. There seems like a connection there.
You know, the interesting thing about him is that he just can't help himself. He gives himself away over and over again. Just like with the Hillary stuff and the Russian stuff. Like, he can't, like, somebody tells him something, he can't keep it under wraps, and he gives it away by tweeting it. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is a coordinated effort. And, you know, I don't know about the prospects of a civil war necessarily. I really don't think the citizenry in Saudi Arabia has the capacity to do it. Look, and even in terms of a war with another state, that's us going to war. Like, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a standing army. Guess who would have to, whose troops would show up? It'd be our troops. And we've done that in the past too. Unless Israel is the one who takes the lead on this. And I think that would be greenlit by all of these countries if that happened. And they have the capacity to wage a pretty significant air war.
I mean, there's not going to be a war in Iran with our current White House not joining in. They aren't going to let that, like, pass by without them getting on the bandwagon.
He just wants a war badly. And, you know, by the time this Asia trip ends, maybe he will have... maybe they will have figured out how to avoid a North Korean war, and that leaves Iran. So, all right. Well, that's all I have for now. I don't have a lot of details, but I'll keep, you know, on top of the story, see what else happens.
I suspect this will come back again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is just the beginning.
So we'll close out on going to talk about last week, which was the Mueller indictments, the case against Manafort and his business partner, who's also part of the campaign, is ongoing. They're now fighting about bail. They're under house arrest and they want to not be under house arrest. And Mueller saying, well, if you want to get not under house arrest, you have to tell us what your actual assets are under oath, because Manafort, of course, has reported all kinds of like money situations, and it's not clear yet what money he does have or doesn't have or where his assets are stored. And until that's resolved, there's no point in letting him not have restrictions on his movement while waiting trial, which is set for May of 2017. But let's go to Papadopoulos for a bit.
This guy's fascinating.
Yeah.
I can't figure out if he's like a coffee runner or if he's like a high level.
He's not a coffee runner. He's not a high level. He's another useful idiot and like a whole campaign full of useful idiots. But what I found interesting is looking at like the history we have here of the various filings in the case that Mueller made and comparing some of the media reports that were going on at the same time. Now, to explain why this might be important, let's look at the timeline of what happened. We know on July 27th is when Papadopoulos was coming back from Munich, apparently, and got into Dulles Airport and was arrested. On the 28th, there is a filing in this case. They put under seal. It's a complaint. A warrant for his arrest the day after he's actually arrested. And we don't really know what happens after that. Papadopoulos does have an attorney. They waive like preliminary hearings. So that all went by. And then we don't hear anything more until October 5th when he actually enters his plea. What Papadopoulos was doing between those two dates, we still don't know yet. Other than the fact, you know, he had multiple sessions with Mueller and his team on the record interviews and produced more documents to them. But in between the very first filing, which was July 28th, and the second filing, which was October 5th, there was an article in the Washington Post on August 15th, all about Papadopoulos, which was interesting because there had been basically nothing about this guy since forever, when people were making fun of the fact that his resume listed the fact he was like a UN representative, which turns out to be a lie, by the way. You know you're scraping the bottom of the barrel when like your guy's resume has member of Model UN, and it was inflated.
Wait a minute, Model UN?
It was something, yeah.
Okay.
And it wasn't even true. I mean, this guy, I found out actually how he managed to get involved in the world of politics. He sent a LinkedIn message to Ben Carson's campaign.
Oh my God.
And Ben Carson was so in need of foreign policy people that he's like, yeah, good enough.
He's on the model. My daughter's been in the Model UN. Oh my God, kill me now.
Already more qualified by far than this guy is.
Probably.
So, but again, so this is a strange article at the time. I remember thinking, what's going on here? Because why would someone suddenly leak to reporters about the fact that Papadopoulos had been trying to set up meetings with Russians? And I think now we know why. Mm. Because the whole tone of that article is to sort of give an excuse to the Trump campaign. The way the article is written is to suggest that this was all Papadopoulos. Nothing to do with the Trump campaign. He was out. Papadopoulos was out on his own. Coffee boy was getting way over his head. For instance, the articles say, while the emails illustrate Papadopoulos' eagerness to strengthen the campaign's connections to the Russian government, Papadopoulos does not spell out in them why it would be in Trump's interest to do so. His entreaties appear to have generated more concern than excitement with the campaign, which at the time was looking to seal the Republican nomination and take on a heavily favored Hillary Clinton in the general election. So the whole article is like, wow, the Trump campaign is so concerned by what this guy's doing.
They're favorable to Trump, yeah.
Yeah, and
does that mean, that probably means what, one of them leaked it, right?
Well, it's got to be. It very much clearly is, because it's what we know from the article is that someone was reading these emails out to the Washington Post reporter.
Oh, Jesus.
And they do actually have, they do have some emails showing, like Papadopoulos was saying, meeting with Russian leadership, including Putin, and proposing it. But for that email, what the person who's the leaker told the Washington Post reporter is that Sam Clovis, the campaign co-chairman, and other Trump advisors like Charles Kubik were raising legal concerns or thought NATO allies should be consulted or expressing like alarm that this was happening. So, I mean, what we know now is that someone on August 15th was determined to throw Papadopoulos under the bus. Why that's interesting is because you look at the very first complaint that Mueller filed, and it mostly cites emails between Papadopoulos and his Russian contacts. It also has a couple times where he forwards emails from Russian contacts to people in the campaign and says Russia updates and lets them know. But it doesn't really even discuss what Papadopoulos was telling the campaign about all this going on. And then we have the Washington Post article with all these favorable leaks. And on October 5th, Mueller does a new filing, a statement of the offense and an affidavit for as part of the sort of the plea hearing for Papadopoulos. And it's very different from the original complaint. This time it includes a lot more in the way of internal communications in the Trump campaign. And it also, interestingly, seems to track the Washington Post article. For instance, the Washington Post article talked about the initial email sent by Papadopoulos, where it just says, you should have a meeting with Russian leadership. And what Mueller includes is that it wasn't just Russian contacts this guy had, it was someone claiming to be Vladimir Putin's niece. And rather than expressing alarm in response, like the WaPo article seems to suggest, Mueller's filing includes like quotes from other emails in that chain, such as, for instance, in the WaPo article, Clovis is quoted as saying, we thought we should probably not go forward with any meeting with the Russians until we have occasion to sit with our NATO allies. But Clovis in the Mueller complaint says, I will work it through the campaign, but no commitments to be made yet. Great work.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, so that's kind of the whole tenor, is that each time there's an email that was quoted in the Washington Post that sort of plays this off as like Papadopoulos was given, you know, the cold shoulder and not welcomed, they'll quote the rest of the email, which shows that's not what the WaPo leak was implying.
You know, it's interesting to me. So that would mean that the reporter who wrote that story basically never actually asked to see the emails, right? Like they didn't verify what
they probably did. They just didn't. Well, it's not. They were given true information. They were not being lied to. But for instance,
heavily
let's take
redacted,
the one of the
right?
Manafort
heavily
emails.
Redacted information. That's what it was.
Well, so the WaPo article plays it off as like Manafort rejected the suggestion of a meeting. He was like, here's the quote: Manafort reacted coolly, forwarding the email to his associate Rick Gates with a note: "We need someone to communicate that DT Donald Trump is not doing these trips," in response to a question from Papadopoulos to have Donald Trump meet with Putin. But the rest of the email, which Mueller included, says, we need someone to communicate that DT is not doing his trips. It should be someone low level in the campaign so as not to send any signal. So he was saying strategically, the meeting needs to be done a different way, not that it shouldn't happen. But why I think this matters is that it shows how close to the chest Mueller is playing it. He doesn't need to include all the stuff in these filings, and he didn't at first. It looks to me very much like he only included a lot of these emails in the October 5th filing. As a response to that WaPo leaker to show the full context. Because he had footnotes to, you know, basically to rebut whatever this whole narrative they're trying to put forth is. But there's two things about this. The first is that this suggests that whatever happened after Papadopoulos' arrest, something was leaked to the rest, or something was found out by the Trump campaign, which alerted them that Papadopoulos was on the radar. Now, if they'd known Papadopoulos had flipped, they wouldn't have done it this way because they would know what Papadopoulos could do. But if they thought he just got caught with some dumb emails, maybe this will work. You play with the narrative as like, he's a dumb guy, got caught.
So here's my question though. I understand like the PR impetus in doing it like this, and even with Mueller going back, but like in court, none of this shit matters. I mean, like in, you know what I mean? Like in a criminal prosecution against him, what they leaked to the Washington Post is not necessarily gonna matter unless like that's, I mean, it's not going to help them, is what I'm saying. It's not going to help the administration.
They don't think it's going to court. They didn't think it's going to court. I mean, it's kind of, so look at way back to like, what was it, January, when we have Sessions getting confirmed.
Right.
And he made some very strong statements about how I never talked
lies.
To the Russians. I never like heard of any communication with the Russians. And people, including me, I was like, wait, what? But it was kind of a strong signal that actually there's nothing here, because no one who had knowledge of that kind of contact would make a statement like that under oath. It'd be absurd. You'd play it more carefully. You'd be more like wordsmithy, because anyone who makes those statements must be very, very confident that there's nothing that's ever going to come out to prove them wrong. But it turns out there was a lot of stuff that could come out and prove him wrong. And he said it anyway, which suggests that they are expecting this stuff not to come out and not to go to court. And it's all about public opinion, which makes me, and back to the Mueller's complaint, the October 5th filing in the Papadopoulos case. One of the additional internal campaign emails that was included, that was not included in the initial filing, comes from April and involves Papadopoulos writing to a person only identified as senior policy advisor. It doesn't say who it is, and so far no one's identified the senior policy advisor. But Papadopoulos' emails say, the Russian government has an open invitation by Putin for Mr. Trump to meet him when he is ready. The advantage of being in London is that these governments tend to speak a bit more openly in neutral cities. Which shows that this senior policy advisor knew Papadopoulos was in England and was meeting with Russian government officials about the Trump campaign. Which means the identity here of senior policy advisor is going to be super important, I suspect. I don't think Mueller included that by accident. I think that was a warning shot.
Who do you think it is?
I think it's someone close to Sessions. I think this is a warning to Sessions. Stop making the claims you're making. We have evidence otherwise.
You think Sessions would know better? I mean, like, does he not know who he's dealing with?
But he doesn't. That shows his mindset. Is he thinks they can control what's happening to such a degree that they can make statements contradicted by evidence on the record and it's not going to hurt them. And Mueller is saying it's going to hurt you. My guess is senior policy advisor is Stephen Miller.
Oh, I was thinking Flynn.
Oh, no. This is, well.
This was before Flynn left the, you know, Flynn was still around.
Yeah. Huh. It could, you know, that could work too.
I would take either one of them. And, you know, if he could put either one of them away, that's great. But I feel like Flynn is, I feel like, really, really vulnerable here.
Oh, Flynn's vulnerable. Well, Flynn has a sort of a different set of Russian connections.
Yeah.
I mean, they all have their own. That's the thing. Like, there's like 9 people in the campaign with Russian contacts, but they all have their own set of Russian contacts.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like a coordinated conspiracy between like one on one. It's like 9 on 9 or probably more than that.
He brought together, he surrounded himself with people who are very comfortable with Putin, who work with Russian oligarchs, who have some connection. I mean, like, this is not coincidental.
No.
Right?
Yeah. Not
so,
at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And Wilbur Ross, it came out this weekend too.
Right.
He actually has business interests with Putin's son-in-law.
What are they, the Paradise Papers or something? What is it called?
Yeah, Paradise Papers. And he has to recuse himself from things having to do with shipping. This is our Commerce Secretary. And he has to recuse himself from everything to do with shipping because he has a shipping business with Putin's son.
Oh my God.
It's a kleptocracy.
Well, Trump already said, he said this last week, that, you know, the State Department only needs me. Didn't he say that?
Oh, God. He said he was asked about why he hasn't hired in the State Department. He says, I'm the only one that matters. I'm the only one who matters. And it also came out again, because the news comes out at a voracious pace, that at a meeting with a Native American group, they were talking about, you know, getting access to energy resources and how regulations were preventing that. And Trump told them, just do it anyway. I don't feel like you're hearing me here. Just do it anyway. Instructing them to disregard the law and just do it. Because once it comes out of the ground, you can't put it back, so it's fine.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yep.
But I suspect that like the next move we're going to see from Mueller has to do with senior policy advisor, whether it is Sessions-related or Flynn-related. I bet it's one of those two. Because, again, there's no reason to include it in there unless you're sending a signal.
And Sessions doesn't he doesn't enjoy the kind of privileges the president does, right? I mean, like, as attorney general.
He recused himself.
No, right. No, but I'm talking about, like, in terms of being subject to, like, prosecution and stuff, being charged with.
Oh, he doesn't. He doesn't. But he also is inventing all kinds of privileges for himself, like a privilege not to talk about things to talk to Trump about. They're not going to give up without a fight, and it's going to get dicier before we start getting more clarity here.
I wonder if Mueller's going to make his moves before Trump gets back.
He might. I think this is, we're looking a little bit sooner rather than later. I think before the end of 2017, we're going to have some serious movements going on in this case, even more than we've seen so far.
He should probably move as fast as he can, considering everybody's trying to get rid of him on the right. So he should probably move quick.
Yeah.
All right.
Godspeed, Mueller.
Godspeed, Mueller. Yeah. Okay. I think that's it for us this week. And, anything else?
Nope. We'll be back next week to discuss the new chaos that's occurred.
Yeah, and I really hope between now and then that there is not another case of, you know, all this loss of life for us to have to discuss and digest again. All right, guys. Thanks so much, and we'll be back in a week. A
big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.